Hey friends, it's your intrepid warrior, David Landjuli, on the Leadership Deep Dive Show with my good friend and colleague, Margaret Katz-Canny. Margaret.
Hey, David, welcome to. We're in the same state today, so that's always fun.
Yeah, I am in Avon, Colorado, where Margaret and I met up earlier this week,
Yeah.
and with her partner Kevin, and we had a nice little walk along the river and a nice lunch
We
together.
did. Yeah.
And Margaret, we've got a great guest today, Barry Moline. Hey, Barry.
Hey, David. Hey, Margaret. It's great to be with you.
We're happy to have
Welcome to
you.
the show. Thank you for being on. And we're going to talk about ethical influence with Barry. He's an expert in this field. But before I do that, I want to introduce Barry a little bit. Give you a little folks in the audience a little bit more about you, Barry. You have mastered the art of teamwork, negotiation, management, and influence over the nearly 3 decades in the CEO seat. You're an award-winning author and relentless student of what helps people work better together. So Margaret and I love that. And you're also a certified licensed trainer and founding member of the Cialdini Institute, whose book influenced me more than 20 years ago, I have to say. So I'm happy to talk more about that with you. You bring a deep expertise in the science of persuasion and how people make decisions, and how leaders can ethically bring more people on their side. Your work helps teams elevate their marketing, sales, fundraising, and everyday efforts that move life forward. So, welcome, Barry.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, David. I look forward to the conversation.
All right. So, well, when you reached out, or maybe your podcast, Booker reached out to me, and what caught my eye was this phrase, ethical influence. So maybe you could say as for the audience, like what does that even mean, in, especially in today's world?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, influence on its own is generally moving people in your direction. And we'll leave it at that. We could go deeper, we could give examples, but we're trying to persuade people to an idea that we have, to a movement that we have. So, we want people to do something that we're suggesting. So that's the influence part. Ethical is very important because we can think of lots of ways where people try to sell us something and we feel like this isn't a good match for me. This isn't quite right for me. It feels dirty, scummy. So when we talk about influence, we're only talking about ethical influence and what I mean by that.
Well, it could be a really good podcast. Like, and sh we could have like the manipulative influence show,
Oh.
with you, and we could probably contrast ethical influence against manip. I worked with someone many years ago in the private sector who was absolutely artful at manipulative influence. Yeah.
Well, I think what's important is that when you know the elements of influence, then you can spot when people are, one, trying to influence you, and clearly when they're doing it in a way that is unethical or manipulative.
Yeah.
So what I mean by ethical is, number one, it has to be true. Now, facts can still be interpreted from, we can both see the same car accident and disagree on the facts, on the speed of the car, or was it turning, was it not turning? Nevertheless, but now, we can get in the ballpark of what we believe is true. So still it has to be something that we can say is based on some evidence. Okay. So number one is true. The second element of ethics is it has to sort of be common sense. People have to look at that and say, yeah, I can see that. I can understand why that would happen. And again, it's something that you go with your gut, but it has to, it can't be something that's so offbeat that you go like, nah, I don't get that, or no, that's not right for me. It has to make sense for you. And then the third one, which I think is the most important, is it has to be wise. And what I mean by that is that it has to be a recommendation that you make. If I'm trying to influence you and Margaret, this has to be something that I would also recommend for myself, for my family, for my kids, for my parents, for my friends, for my colleagues. So if I don't believe it, if I don't subscribe to it, then it's hard for me to influence somebody else. Then it becomes manipulative. So those are the three elements. It has to be true, it has to make common sense, and it has to be wise. It has to be something I would do myself. And when you have those three characteristics, then you have something that is ethical. And I think ethics is a moving target. You know, it's defined in the moment. So that's the best I feel as though we can do in trying to evaluate whether an argument is ethical.
I'm sort of, I mean, what comes up for me first is this idea of influencing like with a sale, right? Because I think you said sometimes people end up feeling dirty. And I'm just struggling a little. So there's a question in here to me where it starts to feel manipulative is where your no is not respected, right? Like if you choose this isn't my product, and I know I'm using a lot of yous. Let's say I choose like I don't want to buy this car. And the salesperson is not letting me leave, not accepting my no. That's where it feels to me where things slide into manipulation. So help me understand how your three things are missing when somebody won't let you say no, or if I'm off to the wrong start here on understanding this.
The situation you're describing happens to us, I don't know, from time to time. And yeah, it does feel wrong, or it feels scummy. The salesperson who's effectively not taking no for an answer is sort of going about it the wrong way. What we want to do when we're trying to move people in our direction is find something in their life, talk about what's, their background, what's happening to them, on a day-to-day basis that connects to the thing that we are trying to move them toward. And, we could talk about a car, but nevertheless, well, and in the example of
Well,
the car.
let's talk about a cause since there are a lot of nonprofit leaders and fundraisers in the audience. Like, even as a fundraiser, we could fall into the trap of not letting the no be a real be a no and try to manipulate that person by pulling their heartstrings or. So there's a lot of gray area in this, I think, whether you're in sales or in fundraising. But certainly, fundraisers and nonprofit leaders are in the business of getting people to come alongside them in the work that they're up to. And human beings are human beings, and fundraisers are fundraisers, and they have pressures on them to raise money for the cause. And you can very easily fall into a trap of manipulation if you're not careful.
Yeah, I'm wondering, sorry,
Go ahead.
just if maybe, if you fail as a fundraiser, if I were to fail as a fundraiser to do the things that would be required to really align with my donor and for me to communicate my genuine belief in what was happening, if I failed to do those things and I could feel the donor sort of pulling away, metaphor, person walking back towards their own car and not buying my car, then we move into manipulation mode, perhaps. After we've failed to be ethical, question mark.
Well, to me, when that person is walking away, the salesperson has failed at connecting them to the vehicle. And we'll get to a cause in a second, but connecting them to the vehicle, they haven't asked the person, what do they need this car for? And let me find the right car for you. If you need a family car versus a sports car, Those are two different conversations. So if the salesperson doesn't know enough about their potential client, then they have failed at understanding where that connection is. So when we talk about a cause, one of the things that I marvel at is I think I see it during the World Series, the baseball World Series, and they do a connection. I don't know if they're actually doing fundraising. I think that they do mention the opportunity for making a contribution or a donation, but they have people who are in the park, and they give them a I don't they give them a placard, and on the placard is something that is associated with breast cancer. And well, I'm not sure if it's breast cancer. No, I think it's just cancer. And then they ask people during a certain, the break of a certain inning, do you know somebody in your life that has been affected by cancer? And if you have, then hold up your card. And pretty much everybody has had that experience where they just know somebody in their life who's dealt with cancer. So you have a sea of people in the baseball game who are holding up cards, and the connection is amazing. The commentators are the broadcasters are talking about cancer, and then they mention the opportunity to contribute. But the point is that we all have some kind of connection to cancer, whether it's us directly, immediate family, friends, colleagues, somewhere. And that is when we talk about the car salesman, they haven't made that connection. They've got to be able to make that connection first. Is that manipulative? I think it's part of everyday life. I think when we want to move people to our side, we have to understand who they are. But it's not just influence and persuasion. It works for teams, just in the office. If we want a better team, we need the people on our team to know each other better. So we don't have to love each other. It's just good to know each other's backgrounds. Now, we're not talking about making any contributions or fundraising. We're just talking about doing good work together. We do better
Yeah,
work for
well,
each other
let me pause you there.
when we know
Let me
each
pause
other.
you there. I would call this living in the land of living in the land of rapport, building rapport with people. Like when we got on the show today, Barry, you and I had already met and built some rapport, and we had a conversation, and we got to know each other, and what you're up to in the world, and what we're up to, and that starts to build the relationship, connection, rapport. And then Margaret wasn't on the part of that conversation, so we took some time today before we recorded for you to get to know Margaret, and there is some similarity. You both know people in Boulder, Colorado, so you find this common. This is, I think, just without manipulation at all. It's just finding common ground or finding some likeness, I think, is what Cialdini would call this, right? Likeness.
Yeah, liking. Yeah, liking. And
Liking.
so, we do business with people that we like. And when we think about the inverse of that, if we come across a salesperson who's a jerk, or who just has a rotten personality, we tend to move away from that person because we just don't like being around that person. But when we have something in common with somebody, then we tend to stick around and engage and want to, hang out more with that person. And if they're a salesperson and we have something in common with them, then yeah, we like doing that. And it also works when we can go just sort of beyond that, and just a smidgen beyond that, and try to find something that we both are concerned about, are interested in. Because if we can do that, if we all like dogs and taking care of dogs or pets or something like that, then that's something. Now we're on the team that likes to take care of pets, and that's a sort of a unifying topic. When we talk about that, we feel something in our heart. Oh yeah, I love taking care of animals, and so do you. And that's a unifying topic for us. So what that is one of the strongest elements of influence is finding something that you both care about. So when we dig into our relationship and we find different things that people like to do, we feel like we're on the same team. David, earlier you said to me, look at those guitars, in the background, and you said, oh, I didn't realize you played guitar. And we talked a little bit about guitar, and then we talked about some history that you had playing saxophone. But we were talking about musicianship, being musicians and that experience of being musicians. And I know that that's something that we have in common. It may not be that we're both rock stars in a band, but nevertheless, we've been through the process of trying to, get notes out of a device, and we're kind of on that team, that little bit of team that have tried that together. So that's something now we have in common. When we move to other topics, the best I can say is, I kind of like that guy. I kind of like David. And when Margaret and I, connected over our mutual friend in Boulder, like, oh, I just met Margaret, but I kind of like Margaret, because we talked about this person and we talked about where we met this person and so on. So we're making those connections and we're feeling like, oh, I kind of like these folks. So we're kind of on the same team.
I think that's well within the boundaries of ethics would be to, if you know that I'm a fundraiser and you've accepted a meeting with me and I'm starting to get curious about those guitars, but that's just getting to know each other, right? There's nothing manipulative or unethical of just getting to know somebody. So I do think that's well within the realm. And in fact, if I was not to do that as a fundraiser, I would be committing malpractice.
Right. That's true. You want to have a relationship because you want to connect people with your cause.
But there was something you said about truthfulness, that I'm curious your thoughts on, because I do a lot of work with leaders around integrity, and truthfulness would live in the land of integrity. But there's something about it, in integrity, we could just say by definition, the word means a state of being whole and complete. Whole and complete, that's actually what the word means. So a lot of other things get mixed up with it. That, ethics would certainly be in the realm of integrity, but it's not the same thing as integrity. But here's where I think it gets a bit sticky for fundraisers and anybody really who wants to influence, is if you know something about your organization or about the product and you do not reveal it, that is to say, you withhold it from the prospective donor or from the prospect who you're trying to sell something to, and you withhold it, that's actually out of integrity. In other words, it's not a whole and complete in that you have not disclosed that defect or that your organization's head is one breath away from bankruptcy, while you're in this fundraising conversation. So I'm interested in your thoughts on integrity as part of telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's important that if we're moving somebody in our direction, that we tell them there are pros and cons, and let me be forthcoming about that. Here are the reasons why we'd like you to invest in our cause, and this is all the good things that we're doing. There are some things that are, maybe we've come through a difficult period, and and I want to tell you what's gone on, but we're on a different path now that we see a bright future for, and we'd like you to invest in that bright future. So it's okay to talk about both. In fact, Warren Buffett would when he was active in Berkshire Hathaway, in every letter every annual letter that he would send to his investors, he would say, "Here's our performance for the year. We had a fine year, and our portfolio went up by 12%." And then he would always, and he would talk about some of the highlights of that. But then he would always turn to, "You know, we could have done better. Here are a few mistakes that we made. And we missed this, and we missed this, and we missed this. And here's what we're doing to correct that." Now, so he's talking about the good things that we did. Then he gets to some of those characteristics or actions that they took that they learned some lessons from. And now we're ready for a great year because we've learned those lessons. We're not going to repeat, that bad behavior. And by pointing that out, we believe Warren Buffett more because he's being introspective. So there is value in saying these are the great things that we're doing, and here are some things that we could improve on, and we're working on those.
I
So
believe.
people have a lot of room for forgiveness,
Yes,
as
I do.
well
And
as understanding that we're not all perfect.
I really hope that any fundraisers who are listening have the volume turned up on that. I mean, this comes up all the time with my clients. And I really understand with compassion for fundraisers, it feels somehow like money is so scarce when you get into that scarcity place that, like, if I don't get a 5-star review, if my review, like, obviously not, we're not reviewing nonprofits in that way, but like if I get a 4.7 because somebody gives me a bad, like, people really start to talk themselves into this shiny, happy only place. And I try so hard. They don't always believe me, but I'm really happy to, have them hear it from a second human. They're like, no, your donors are, well, for the most part, they're actually really good with business and money, which is why they're donors. And they really understand that, that people make mistakes, like, and certainly we learn from our mistakes. We drop the ball sometimes and we have to apologize and take accountability. And that, as you say, with Warren Buffett, this is actually true of all people who are raising money and speaking for nonprofits. Like, the more forthcoming you are, the more your donors think, oh, awesome. And which is different from, David, what you're saying, which is, we're 2 weeks from closing our doors.
I was using that as an extreme example
Yeah.
of when you might withhold. There are, again, it's getting into this gray area of, ethics can not always be so black and white, although I tend to be more of a black and white kind of person. But as I've matured, I've learned that there is more gray between the black and white, and that's where things can get very tricky. If you are in a position, you're the representative as the fundraiser, you're the represent you could be the executive director of the nonprofit with lots of insight into all things good and bad that are going on, good quote and bad that are going on, and to what extent do you disclose those things? It's very easy, and I do think this would be unethical, to fall into the trap of not disclosing critical information. I'll add critical information to a donor. It'd be very easy as a person of power, authority, and control of the organization to just happen to not disclose that little dark secret. And maybe it's not necessary, and maybe it is necessary. This is where I think it gets a bit murky, and which is why I really appreciate what the work you're doing, Barry, in terms of helping leaders tease out these ethical questions, because they're not always so clear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. When you buy a house, I believe there are a list of things you must, somebody died in the house or there was a flood in the house. I mean, I think there's a list, and I don't think anywhere else is it that clear what you must talk about and what you are, have some discretion over.
And it is important to recognize that people have a tremendous capacity for understanding problems. We're all humans. We all live in a life where we have problems. And what people want to hear just beyond that is what's the plan to fix it? And do the pros outweigh the cons? And that's what's most important. And it's even better to identify what the problems are up front so that people can say, oh, I know what I'm getting into, and I want to be part of the thriving plan.
Yeah. Gary, I'm
There's a
curious.
word,
Oh,
oh,
go
there's a
ahead.
word that you used earlier, scarcity, and it's a topic that Margaret and I speak about quite a bit in our work and workshops and coaching with nonprofit leaders, because there's this, generally speaking, I think, Margaret, you have to see if you agree with me on this, but if you're coming from a place of scarcity in your fundraising, it might have some impact, but more often than not, it's not a very powerful place to be coming from an influence standpoint. And this is contradictive to the Cialdini model, where you use scarcity as a way of influencing someone. So I'm a little bit confused here, because the stand that Margaret and I often take, and a lot of nonprofits are in this scarcity mode, but leading with that in a fundraising conversation isn't always a way you bring people over to your side. And yet that's one of the pillars of Cialdini's model. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this, because I'm very confused right now.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and this is something we should explore deeply to try to figure out what the best application is. So let me give you an example of good scarcity. Okay, well, no, actually, let's start out with bad scarcity. It's just a quick example, and that is, we have holidays throughout the year: the 4th of July sale, the President's Day sale, the Labor Day sale, and products are at a reduced price during those time frames, and they might be a week-long sale and whatever. And we as consumers, if you think about it, if you're ready to buy, that's a good time to buy. But if you miss this window, this will be on sale in a few months, so I don't have to worry. If I can hold my breath for a little longer, I don't really need a TV right now, but I'll wait 3 months or 6 months when they go back on sale, and I'll buy it then. So that is scarcity that is misused and generally ineffective, because sometimes people will jump, but generally what they're doing is they're just waiting for the next sale to come along, and they'll buy then. Scarcity that's real is when you're running out of something. So, for example, you're holding a conference, and the conference is at a certain date. You want people to register for your conference, so you give them a deadline, a time that they can register and get a reduced price. And that reduced price time frame is probably like 3 weeks before the conference. But you need that deadline in order to know how big to set the room, how many chairs you need, how much shrimp to buy for the reception. And so literally you have to know that number. And you encourage people to register for that conference, by that date, and then you get a pretty good estimate of about the size of your conference. And then the price goes up automatically. And if you use registration software, you actually have to put that information in, and you put in the higher price for what the price is, between 3 weeks into the date of the meeting begins. So that's automatic. It's not going to change. There's no special deals that you can offer. Those are the prices. We're trying to move people to register early. So that is an example of scarcity that, we only have this many, cans of soda that we're giving out. And if you're the first, 100 people to come in, you get a can of soda. And then we're just going to run out of those cans. We're not going to give them to anyone else. And they could be specialty mugs, they could be certain gifts, and so on. And that's that. That's appropriate scarcity. And, I don't want to say the unethical, but the less effective scarcity is the continuing sale that we will see every few months.
Yeah. Well, what I'm hearing from that is we're maybe talking about even a third aspect of scarcity here, which is to say that in the nonprofit world, there may not be revenue generating models that are consistent and covers the full cost of the service that the social service that you might be offering, which is why you're out fundraising. And so there is a real shortfall, we could call it that. And some that shortfall or scarcity, and that has some timeliness associated with it, could be convincing for a donor, and often is. But then, when you're constantly in a state of scarcity, I think my sense is that the psychology of this turns upside down with some donors, where the point, they get to the point where, like, okay, you just can't, your business model's not working. You're not, you're always in scarcity. And coming from there, as opposed to coming from a place of give because we're in scarcity, as opposed to give because this is the great work we're doing in the world. This is like the distinction that Margaret and I often want to help fundraisers make.
Well, I think there's something true about, if I have a budget of $1 million and I've already raised $1.3 million, it's hard to sit in front of a donor and say, we really need your money, unless you have a plan of how, this bigger amount of money is going to expand what you can do. So I do think there's urgency that somehow tucks in with scarcity. But I also think what you're identifying, David, scarcity is a financial thing very often, and it has to do with, I think, this people start to believe that there's so much competition for the dollars, and that they can't even ask for enough, and right, they work themselves till they're going down the drain, but they forget to think about the abundance of the work that they're doing, of the impact that they're having, of the creativity that they're bringing to a problem. If they can talk about the abundance along with urgency, but leave scarcity out of it, it usually goes better, I think, in a nonprofit setting.
Yeah, I mean, scarcity in one example is, let's say you're fundraising for to build, a wing, a new wing in a facility, and the people that invest are going to get their names on a wall, and you've got a time frame. People are investing now, and if you want your name on that wall.
Only four walls, so only four people
Right,
are going to get
exactly.
to.
There's only
Yeah,
going to
right.
be four plaques. There's only going
Yes,
to be
right.
four plaques on four walls.
You're
So
going to
if you
be
want
forced to
that.
name the bathroom if you don't come in now. Yeah,
Yeah, but that is an example of scarcity and it
right.
works.
That's for real.
There's no
Yeah,
question, and it's real and it's
it
ethical
is,
and it
and
works.
it's
Yeah.
ethical. I
So I
love
think
that.
the word scarcity has a lot of different meanings, and so we just have to sort of tease out a little bit, right, David? Because I think that, like, that emotional scarcity, I don't think that helps influence anybody.
Yeah, but I think Barry's given us three really good examples of how to and how not to use two, how to use scarcity in a very ethical way, and one, not so ethical in terms of like, and I see this a lot in television advertising. The next 100 callers, okay, well, the next night the ad comes on, and the next 100 callers, and then the next night the same ad comes on. The next, it's only for the next 100 callers. Well, that was 3 nights of 100 callers, and that starts to border on untruthful. Let's just put
Yes.
it that way. All right.
Yeah.
Well, it's been, wow, time is flying. We are way over time, and I know Margaret has to get off to another call, and I'm sure you do too. Is there something based on this conversation or based on anything in your work with leaders and with organizations that you would want to give the audience to try, or a big open-ended question you might leave them with, something they can take away today?
Yeah. I'll give you an example, and then we'll come to the action item. So of last month, my friend Eric had some foot surgery, and then 2 weeks later, he needed a ride to go to his follow-up doctor's appointment. His wife was busy that day, and he asked if I could drive him to the doctor. And I said sure, and we went to the doctor. I brought him home, and we were chatting at his house. I wasn't hanging around very much, but I made sure he got back in the house from getting out of my car with his crutches and so on. And he was very effusive in his thanking me and really appreciating what I'd done for him and taking the time out this morning. And I said, Eric, that's what friends do for each other. And when I said that, I thought to myself, this may be kind of slimy, because I learned that in my training, from the Cialdini Institute, how to be an ethical trainer. And one of the ways to move people to your side is by doing this thing called reciprocity. You give them something and then they give you something at some point. It's the example of we go into a chocolate shop and what do? They give you samples. And how do you feel? Maybe I should buy something at the chocolate shop, right? So this was a verbal piece of chocolate. So he said, thank you. And I said, that's what friends do for each other. Thinking at some point in the future, I may need a favor from Eric. And he's going to remember that I took him to the doctor. Now, all that sounds kind of, gears that are manipulative. But so I learned that. I learned that. But when I said it for the first time I'd ever used it, Eric, that's what friends do for each other. I thought, ooh, that sounds kind of weird. And Eric said, yeah, that's what friends do for each other, because we're friends. And he interpreted it as this is a confirmation of our friendship. It's not manipulation. It's not that I'm going to do something. Now I feel obligated to do something for you in the future. And Eric would do something for me, even if I didn't bring him to the doctor. But still, the point was, it was confirmation of our friendship saying that. So it in creating that element of teamwork, when we're doing things for people and they say thank you, it's okay to say, make that extra little statement and say, yeah, that's what colleagues do for each other. That's what friends do for each other. That's what congregants do for each other. That's what neighbors do for each other. And leave it at that. Don't make a big deal out of it. And then that neighbor, that colleague, that friend will go like, yeah, we're good neighbors. We're good friends. I like that person. And then sometime in the future, it'll come back to, it's karma. It's basically creating karma.
I love that.
So everybody can
So
do this everywhere.
yeah.
Yeah.
So what
And
I think you're saying, what I would call give to get energy needs to leave
put
that out
that
of
in
the
the
car. That
exactly.
goes
Right.
out here. And just to
Yeah.
genuinely give
As
because you
long as
want
there's no
to.
expectation that you're going to get
Yes.
something right away, you
Right.
just want to keep giving the positive karma and it will come back.
Yeah. Great.
I'm also hearing that as long, if you're using this kind of language, and language is part of influence, and if you're coming from a place of authenticity in your, you genuinely are saying this because you are friends, or you're genuinely saying that's what colleagues do for each other because you're acknowledging the relationship, that is ethical influence.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. All right, so try that, guys. I mean, come from the heart. When you declare, in the workplace, in your neighborhood, in your congregation, in your family, that's what we do for each other, and that is ethical influence.
Yeah, it works. Trust me, it works. And it does it in a very light way, and people like hearing it.
Well, that's brilliant, Barry. I know that's not what we talked about. See, these things always emerge through the conversation. So thank you for your brilliance today.
Great.
And
Barry,
where
how
can
can
folks,
people find you
yeah, where can
if they
folks
would
find
like to
you?
learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is barrymoline.com, and you'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
And they can contact me at barry@barrymoline.com.
Great.
Well,
Thanks so
thank
much
you for
for being
coming on the
here.
show. Thanks for being with us, and thank you for sharing in an ethical way. And you certainly influenced us today, and I think you did so with the audience as well. Thanks so much, Barry.
Thank you, David. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you.